This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with David Bigg. How are you, David?
Great, Chris. Thank you very much for having me.
Not a problem. Yeah. We're at the Real Drinks...
Real Drinks Company?
Company, yeah. Not the Real Drinks Group, because that's a completely different business. Yeah. The Real Drinks Company up here in, what is it?
We're on the Waterston Estate, so...
Is that in Berkshire or...
Buckinghamshire.
Buckinghamshire. I always get confused between the two. I can't even say Berkshire. I think it's Berkshire, isn't it?
Berkshire is, just below us, yeah.
Yeah, and my wife just gives me a hard time, because I always call it Berkshire. It's like Kiwi. All right. And we're in what is not a wine business in the slightest, although you like to call yourself the champagne of
we're not allowed to say we're the champagne of anything frankly.
That's right,
because I will have the champagne lawyers on my back. But we are an alternative to champagne, a non-alcoholic alternative to champagne. We ferment tea like wine or sparkling wines.
And if listeners have ever heard of a product called kombucha, it's... You say you're not kombucha, but it's very similar to kombucha. It's just that the process doesn't use what's called a SCOBY, which is a big mat of bacteria and yeast.
Yeah.
The reason we're doing this for you guys is because we've been doing a lot of tastings, and over the years we're getting more and more people in our wine tastings requesting non-alcoholic beverages.
Yeah.
We've used your product in our tastings or as one of the non-alcoholic beverages in the past. And it's got a fermentation process. It's similar to wine. It tastes a little bit like wine. So it's sort of it's not wine in any way, shape, or form, but it does fill that non-alcoholic wine-like product.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are served in many of the top restaurants around the country. People like the Fat Duck and Gavroche and Manoir, etc., as the leading non-alcoholic wine, although we are not a wine, or we're not, let's say, we are not produced with grapes. What we are is a fermentation of tea. In producing our sparkling teas, we go through a very similar process to winemaking, but rather than it being just purely a yeast fermentation, it is a yeast and bacterial fermentation.
Yeah.
And so that bacteria is consuming all of the alcohols in that process and producing something that, say, non-alcoholic. It's got about 0.5% alcohol, so sits in that non-alcoholic space. But the flavor profile, you'll probably find, is closer to a wine than actually most non-alcoholic wines are, because they have to go through that process of extracting the alcohol, and they're also extracting most of the flavor compounds, those fabulous esters that we produce in fermentation. And so it strips most of the flavor out. You have to reconstitute it to put it back into that space. All we do is we ferment, we then filter, and we bottle.
Yep.
Nothing else taken out of it. So very much, very similar to the winemaking process.
Why don't you go through the general process? You've sort of given me a quite a detailed explanation, but I don't think my listeners need quite as much detail. So do you want to just go through it in, you know, two paragraphs or?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're sitting here at our fermentary on the Waterston Estate. We like to think of ourselves very similar to a winery. You can come and visit us.
Looks like a winery.
Yeah.
The tanks look like a winery.
Yeah. So, you know, you come and do a wine tour in spirit here in a similar sort of way. So what we do is we produce a big pot of tea. We put our teas, phenomenal loose leaf teas, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that later on, alongside a certain amount of sugar, relatively small amount of sugar we ferment with, and then that goes into our fermenters, big 10,000 liter tanks, just similar to winery as you're mentioning, and we then put into there our yeasts and our bacteria that we have propagated up. We've grown up, and then we put them in a certain amount, certain levels, and they ferment over a period of sort of between 3 and 6 weeks, a very gentle, very gradual fermentation that produces all of the fabulous flavors that we get in our drinks and in our fermentations before we then take it out. We filter it. Again, quite a complex process of filtration to get it back to a clear product that reads very, very similar to a champagne or a sparkling wine. And we bottle it into 750 bottles that are, again, our serve is very similar to a sparkling wine.
Now, the difference between you guys and a kombucha is that a kombucha uses a thing called a SCOBY.
Yep.
And a SCOBY, I've got the description of a SCOBY. It's a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast,
yep,
which is what you're using. But yep, it's a solid ball of stuff that you move from tank to tank, or you halve and do whatever you do with it. But you guys don't use a SCOBY, so that's why you don't call yourself a kombucha,
yeah,
typically. So what are you doing that's different to that?
Yeah, so our origin comes out of kombucha. So I started fermenting a kombucha back years ago. But kombucha is a wild fermentation, which is, as you talk about, the SCOBY. That is generally grows up over time. And it has, you know, all of those different yeasts and bacteria that are present in the air around us, and they slowly build up in there. And it's a wild fermentation. One day it can taste one way, and the next day it can taste quite different, because the different yeasts and bacteria will grow up more strongly in one brew and less in another. So what we've done is we've taken more of a winemaker's art to this. So we have isolated out all of the yeast and bacterial strains we find in there, identified which ones of those are useful to us and which ones actually create just off flavors or difficulty in fermentation, etc. And we grow up those individual yeast and bacteria. We talk about it as a spice rack. So we deploy the different yeasts and bacteria depending upon the flavors that we want to get out of our teas. And so it is, let's say, a hybrid between that wild fermentation in kombucha and the much more controlled fermentation that you get out of sparkling wines. So we look at ourselves as a sparkling tea.
And the thing about this fermentation process, which I thought was really interesting when I was doing a little bit of research with this, is that you start off with a little bit of sugar in your tea,
yep,
which goes through some sort of fermentation and typically converts it to alcohol.
Yeah.
And then you've got different bacteria, like acetic acid bacteria, taking that alcohol and then breaking it down into acids.
That's right.
And one of the things you don't think about with tea is tea's not a particularly acid drink. Yeah. Wine is.
Yep.
And your product, I've tried them, and you say, oh yeah, they're quite acidic. They're not as acidic as I was expecting,
yeah,
but they do have a backbone of acidity, certainly more than you get, say, at beer, which has almost no acidity.
Yeah.
Tea has no acidity, not as acidic as wine, but you do have that structural element in there as well, which I think is quite good. You know, you don't, a lot of non-alcoholic beverages, they're balancing acidity and sugar. You know, like a cocktail, you know, a normal cocktail is a balance between acidity and sugar. And you've got that acidity. You don't have a lot of sugar there. You're saying that, how much is your tip?
Between 2 and 3% generally, yeah.
Grams of sugar?
So that would be 20 to 30 grams per litre.
Per litre.
Yeah, so 2 to 3%. So, yeah, very low levels of sugar compared to soft drinks. It sits, we were talking about earlier, you know, it sits in the sec region of champagnes. We're not in the Brut, which are the very dries, but we're not in the sweet champagne.
Yeah.
So sort of sitting in the middle of a
20,
champagne.
20, 30 grams. I thought it was a little less than that, because I would have normally expected to be able to, 20, 30 grams I'd normally put in the sort of off dry to medium dry category, but it tastes drier than that.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have the real, I mean, you're saying the pH of this is?
Sits around the 2.9 to 3, so it's actually smack banging in the middle of a white wine. It's not very dry and acidic, those very sharp, very citrusy wines, which might be sitting, my expertise in wine isn't so deep as yours, but might be sitting in that 2.7s. But we are, yeah, pretty much in the middle of white wine territory.
The other thing that this product's got that is quite nice, and I think that's quite nice, is it's just, you've got a couple of the products have got a little bit of tannins to them, or bitterness. I think you described it as astringency or whatever
that's right.
And I think it's quite nice when you get that tension between a little bit of sugar, a little bit of acidity, and a little bit of bitterness. And that creates, for me, in the mouth, it's a much more interesting drink than if you're just playing off sugar and acidity a little bit. So I think, yeah.
And that's been our entire focus all the way through. I mean, we've been doing this now for, time goes on, 7 years plus, coming on 8. It's all been about creating that balance in a similar way to a winemaker's art. So, you know, our focus is We look at four dimensions to this. So we talk about astringency, acidity, sweetness, and top notes. And the top notes are those esters, those fruity notes that come through. And we're starting with something, yes, that tea is very astringent. Okay? If you oversteep a cup of tea, you'll notice how bitter it is on the palate, how drying it is. We then sweeten it, but then in fermentation, we're driving the development of that acidity with the bacteria creating that acidity and those top notes. And it's getting that balance absolutely right is what we do in the fermentary. I'm pointing behind me into the in the tanks behind me in there to just get that balance exactly right so that you get that balance in the glass.
Okay. The process of fermentation, particularly when you're doing a wild fermentation, is notoriously difficult.
Yeah.
And it was funny, you wouldn't let me into the room because I was like, I don't know. I think it was partly you think I was going to write down some state secrets about how you do it, really. But you also were worried about hygiene and all that sort of stuff. And kombuchas do have a problem in that there have been deaths associated with it. People say it's supposed to be healthy, but then people say it's not really recommended for people who've got weak immune because you can get problems with acidity levels. And, I mean, this is what I've read.
I think in the kombucha world, there's a lot of myth as well around it. I'm sure a few people have died from drinking wines at some point in history. Yeah. With anything, if you consume it in the wrong way or whatever, there could be an issue. When you say deaths, I think there are a couple of reported deaths in the US, but no one was able to tie them back particularly to kombucha, but they felt that there might be an association. But
I think that's fair enough. And one of the things about when I was reading about the problems with it is associated with the SCOBY going a little bit rogue on the people, whereas you're not actually using a SCOBY and you're injecting it with, it's like using inoculated yeast. You know exactly what you've got and you're putting it in there. So I can see why it's probably less of a risk with your products anyway than a traditional kombucha anyway.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as I said, I don't believe fundamentally that there is a significant risk from consumption of kombucha, but we know exactly what's going in. We are putting a number of yeasts that we've grown up specifically. We have a number of bacteria. They're propagated in a sterile environment, and they are then deployed into our liquid in exactly the same way as producing a wine. We know that exactly the nature of those different yeast and bacterial strains.
Now, you've got three products, and we had a little taste of the three products.
Dry Dragon,
Royal Flush,
and Peony Blush.
Yeah. So the Royal Flush, I thought was quite nice. It had a real peachy, fruit-driven style of note to it. It was quite clean. Because it doesn't have alcohol, it didn't have that sort of weight in the mid palate that you'd expect. But at least you hadn't sort of packed it out with sugar, which is what I hate when I'm tasting an non-alcoholic wine. Is they go, well, it's a bit hollow in the mid palate. Let's fill it up with sugar.
Yeah.
And I'd rather have something a little bit hollow in the mid palate than fill it up with sugar, which is what a lot of people have done. So I think I thought that was quite nice. The other one, the Dry Dragon, was not to my taste.
Yeah.
There was quite strong. I would have used the word lactic acid type notes. It's almost like you use lactic acid bacteria. Not that you'd admit to any particular product.
We talk about it as a slightly savoury note that comes through in it. And we have obviously enormous fan base of Dry Dragon because it has more complexity to it, but it's slightly more learnt flavour profile than Raw Flush, which is very easy to drink to start with.
It's very peachy. You're not going to like this, but I described it as cheesy Watsons.
Yeah.
Which is not... I know that's not going into your marketing plan.
That's not going on our tasting notes.
And then the last one was the new one, isn't it?
Peony Blush, yes. Our rosé, which is... Yeah, we launched it just a few weeks ago, but it's gone absolutely mad, particularly with the warm weather we've been having. It's a wonderful fruit leading again with summer fruits and a little bit of nougat sort of back notes to it as a fabulous summer rosé.
To me, it smelled a lot like Muscat wine, like a Muscat d'Alexandre or a Moscato d'Asti or one of those sort of things. It has that real punchy muscat, but it also had a flavour I normally call musk in there as well, which is for any Kiwis there. It smells like those purple lollies, the smoker lollies you get as a kid. No one else in the rest of the world. I've tried to explain this to students for years. And in the end, when I went to New Zealand, I brought a bag of them back with me so I can go, look, have a smell and taste of this. This is
musk. You can see that completely blank look on my face.
Yeah. It's musk, though. Musk is a very attractive. Yeah. And it had some sort of a little bit of confected strawberries. It also, it was one of the two that had that little bit of bitterness associated with the tannins, which I kind of like. I think that's quite a nice tension there. So they're the product ranges. Just tell us a little bit about where you've come from, because it's your baby, David.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I founded the company. I started fermenting back in end of 2015, early 2016. It comes from, you know, a friend of mine introduced me to kombucha at the time across the table. He laid out a fabulous meal, a black cod. He was fermenting with a rich black and oolong tea, so it had this sort of flavor profile that sat somewhere between a cider and a beer almost, very earthy. I was fascinated, just completely fascinated by it. I took culture home, put it in a pot, but I put it with a silver needle tea. So again, one of the most exquisite, delicate white teas, which produced notes of rose, vanilla, almond. So you've got these two completely diametric versions of the drink, you know, in a similar way to you'd think about a very light, citrusy white wine and a rich, full-bodied red in terms of that profile. So suddenly it was like, my God, what could I do with this? So it became, well, what I would say a passion, my wife would say an obsession. And I think a lot of fermenters do become quite obsessed by the fermentation process, because it's deeply fascinating. You put a few microbes into a pot and it transforms into something else, you know very well from the wine world. So yeah, we started there, started very much on the countertop, went into the spare room, took over. Well, I said to my wife, I'll take over a little space in the garage, and it, of course, absorbed the whole garage. You know, very shortly after that, as it started to grow, we ended up in places like the Peak Hotel chain, in Hakkasan, in the Fat Duck. So our first foray out into the world was actually in some of the top restaurants around the country. And within a few months, we were in about 60 Michelin-starred restaurants, and with a passionate following amongst some of the greatest sommeliers in the country. Very humbling when you're producing something. I mean, at that time, we were still actually producing in the garage. But you know, getting that sort of response to what we were producing, and very much that food pairing. Their statement that we were the only thing that they come across on the market that actually paired well with food. So, you know, roll forward, we then built our first small fermentary just the other side of Aylesbury here on a farm, very, very sort of rustic, very basic, you know, very much, again, similar to wineries starting out. And then we had this phenomenal opportunity offered to us by the Rothschilds here on the Waddesdon Estate to build a unique non-alcoholic fermentary here. And we opened this in September.
Do they have any equity in it?
No. It's all we've all funded it through myself and friends to get to this stage. So.
You must have some rich friends.
There are some people with some deep pockets who believe very strongly in what we do. So yeah. You know, it is, you know, it's a calling. You know, we have a vision to fundamentally change the way people drink, to be able to offer people the same passion in non-alcoholic drinks as you do in alcoholic drinks. You know, you know obviously what you're doing here with the podcast and what you do out in the world is raising people's awareness, driving that passion in wines. But you know, I was you know, I had quite a nice wine cellar and a nice whiskey collection. But a number of years ago, I decided to pull back. I'll still have a taste of great wine from time to time, but decided to pull back from alcohol. But massively frustrated by the lack of options, but also slightly that lack of respect for non-drinkers. You know, non-drinkers, you know, we even talk about it in that way, you know, but non-alcoholic drinkers, let's say. And so, yes, it's a big drive for us in trying to create that same depth of passion and involvement in the non-alcoholic world as you have in the alcoholic world.
And where are you guys going with the business? You know, because we spoke earlier, you're now in Michelin star restaurants, you're available on Waitrose.
Yeah, Waitrose, Ocado, Sainsbury's, just about expanding to some others down the line as well.
Yeah, yeah. anywhere else, or are you into the...
We're in conversations with a series of others, but we're not specifically in Majestic. We're a lot of specialty stores, so you know, if you go into your local generally independent wine stores, you'll often find us. The Farm Shop and Deli Market, we're present in quite a number of those as well. And just starting to look internationally. So we've been growing and developing so fast within the UK that we really haven't had a time to think much outside of the UK, but we're now in conversation with probably around 20 markets outside the UK as well.
The nice thing you've got compared to wine is that wine is one season a year, you've done it, whereas you can, I presume the teas don't need to be super fresh, do they, or are you limited to when you can ferment?
So, well, the purchasing process is quite interesting. So, you know, as we're talking about our Royal Flush is a first flush Darjeeling, which only we pick only about 10 days in the year. So, you know, when we've just gone through that period, so we buy in a similar way to grapes, in that we have a season. But the tea then persists. And actually, you know, we probably hit our peak maybe 6 months after the pick, because although the tea is produced, oxidized, and then baked off, so it's relatively stable, still the more you keep it, that flavour just evolves. And so you get a slightly more, let's say, dusty note to it. The astringency builds a little bit, and you take away some of those green notes. So probably 6 months in is when it's at its peak. The variance is not great. You know, most people, they probably wouldn't notice the difference between the beginning and a year in. But I'll notice just as we evolve through the season of a slight variance. But no, we can keep it throughout the year, or even probably 18 months or something from the.
But you don't, for example, you don't put vintage dates on your bottles. So do you?
No.
Is it a blend of different vintage teas, or do you tend to work through one lot and then start the next seasons?
We overbuy in the season, so we tend to buy enough that lasts us about 6 months into the next season, because every season is quite different, you know, very much like grapes. You know, some would suggest even more extreme than that, because of the nature of the mountainous environment that you're picking your teas in. And so we will buy, you know, what we're buying now, what we've just purchased, will probably last us into... So we receive those teas that we're buying now in late summer, so in August, September time, and we'll have that tea which will last us not to the following September, but probably 6 to 9 months after that. And then the next season we'll bring in, and then we'll blend. So we'll run down one and we'll run up the other then blend over the transition point. So it's not an immediate one to the next. Having said that, we have one year where we sold through so much that we were finding other teas to blend over that transition, and buying them because usually, you know, particularly with our first flush, when it's sold, you know, you can't, it's very difficult to find it on the open market after that. But we had to do some transition. We had to find some transition teas. So, you know, we've learned from those experiences as well.
One of the things you mentioned when we were talking earlier, because we had quite a bit of a chat earlier, is the locations where you're buying your teas from.
Yeah.
And you're buying some from Darjeeling, which is
yeah.
not just a tea, it's a place.
Yes, absolutely.
For novies like me, you know, Darjeeling is a physical place. It's like a Burgundy or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you're talking about some sites in China.
Yeah.
You're buying your different teas from. How specifically local? You see, when you ran out, you had to try and source some from in the open market. But typically, how local does it get? Does it, you know, like wine, you can go for a regional, you can go for a sub region, you can go to a vineyard, you can go to a particular hillside on a vineyard. You know, is it that type of thing for tea? I don't want to know all about tea. Tea
yep,
is not
absolutely.
My is not my beverage, but.
But no, I mean, that and more, down to the day's pick. So we're sourcing from single estate. So, you know, and I've just come back from Darjeeling for the picking season, where we were working with a particular estate to understand the teas that were coming off, and I'm tasting them as they are coming out. They're being picked and dried and processed, which is all, you know, happens within a few hours. So you can taste the tea as it's coming out of the end of the process. But, you know, if you think, you are dealing with a plantation that might go from 1,800 metres at the top to 800 metres at the bottom. The tea at the top will taste very different to the tea at the bottom. But also, and very critically different from wine, the tea that's picked on day 5 in the picking season will be very different from the tea that's picked on day 10 or day 15 through the picking season. So we're going down to that level of specificity where I'm tasting, you know, throughout the season and across the plantation. And that's when we've already selected the particular tea garden based upon the nature of the tea they produce, which is terroir, the character of the tea estate manager who processes the tea, is the leader in the flavour profile. So we get down to enormous specificity. And I probably, when I was out there, tasted several hundred at least, and I don't know what that means, probably 250, 300 different teas during my time in Darjeeling, to be able to select the particular, what they call invoices, the particular picks that we're then using in our first flush Darjeelings.
Okay, David, I think we'll wrap it up there. Next week, I think what we'll do is we'll explore a little bit more about some of the different locations where you get source teas from, and sort of, you know, what is the relationship? Is it like grapes? You know, do you have wines from different sub-regions, etc.? And the other thing I want to explore is a little bit, even though you're not a kombucha, I'd like to understand that market as well, and a little bit more detail as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's been great talking.